with the Dons was scheduled for first thing after breakfast, meaning I was staying the night and had an evening to kill in the college bar Johnson was propping up with his coterie of acolytes, whose only apparent role in life was to laugh at his jokes. 3 years older than me, and halfway through the second-class degree in classics he coasted through with the diligence he later applied to journalism and red box briefings, you'd have expected him to play the ambassador role, welcoming an aspiring member of his college. Instead, his piss-taking was brutal. In the course of the pint I felt obliged to finish, he mocked my speech impediment, my accent, my school, my dress sense, my haircut, my background, my father's work as a farm worker and garage proprietor, and my prospects in the scholarship interview I was there for. His only motivation was to amuse his posh boy mates. That second-class degree caused Johnson, forever caught in the competitive cycle of Cyril Connolly's permanent adolescence, particular irritation. Years later, when reminded that his rival Cameron and brother Joe had both achieved first-class degrees, he would describe them with characteristically casual misogyny as girly swats who wasted their time at university. In 2019, by now Prime Minister, he would repeat the insult about Cameron in a cabinet paper. Furness's conclusion was both brutal and prescient. In short, he demonstrated all of the character flaws that make him unfit to be our Prime Minister. Nothing I see today suggests he has changed. He's not Falstaff, he's Faust. If you are an ordinary working person and think he has your interests at heart, think again. Decades before his ascent to the highest office in the land, his unsuitability was evident to teachers and fellow students alike. It would soon become evident to employers and colleagues too. In May 1988, having secured a prized graduate traineeship on The Times, he wrote a front-page story about the archaeological discovery of Edward II's long-lost Rosary Palace. "According to Dr. Colin Lucas of Balliol College, Oxford," wrote Johnson, "this is where the king enjoyed a reign of dissolution with his catamite, Piers Gaveston." Conveniently for Johnson, Dr. Lucas, a future vice-chancellor of Oxford University, was his godfather. Somewhat less felicitously, he had said no such thing. Given that Gaveston had been beheaded some 13 years before the palace was built, it would have been remarkable if he had. In an early display of his preternatural lack of conscience, Johnson wrote another entirely manufactured story claiming that the date of the palace's construction was now being disputed. When the full scale of his deceptions became known, not least because of the protestations of his own godfather, Times editor Charles Wilson summarily sacked him. His later account of the incident is revealing if you are interested in the inner workings of Johnson's mind. "It was a complete nightmare of a disaster, and to make it even worse, that very week Colin was trying to become master of Balliol College. He later succeeded, but not that time. Of all the mistakes I've made, I think that takes the biscuit." History does not relate whether the editor of the Daily Telegraph, Max Hastings, was aware of the grounds for Johnson's dismissal from the Times, but it is hard to imagine that he would not be. Nonetheless, he gave him a berth on the newspaper's leader desk. It was here that he developed his distinctive and, for many readers, winning style. Most notable, perhaps, was a habit of referring to readers as "my friends" that would later inform his political speechmaking. It was his next posting, secured partly as a consequence of his peculiar knack for indulging the concerns of the Telegraph's older, distinctly Middle England readership, that would change the course of his career and, incredibly for a young journalist, in many ways, the country. At the beginning of 1989, Hastings sent Johnson to Brussels to report on the European Commission. Previously a pretty dry patch, he quickly discovered that largely mythical tales of overbearing bureaucracy and ridiculous rules were breakfast catnip to Telegraph readers. During this five-year period, Johnson essentially popularised a genre of journalism that would come to define 25 years of EU coverage across most of the UK media, and so indubitably influence the 2016 referendum result. David Usborne, the Independent's EU correspondent at the time, later explained, "He compromised his intellectual integrity to get on," adding that Johnson was well aware that he was writing out of his arse. Peter Guilford, in Brussels for The Times, has spoken of the midnight phone calls he would receive from London when Johnson's inventions landed on editors' desks. "We are under pressure to follow it up," he said. "So there was this sort of Eurosceptic-generating machine that we were all part of, and Boris was driving harder than anyone else." I'm not sure the significance of this cynical but enormously successful opportunism can be exaggerated. Political enmity towards the EU had previously been a largely Benite project of the left, while more populist Eurosceptic journalism, such as it was, had been typified by the vulgar xenophobic posturings of Murdoch lieutenants such as Kelvin McKenzie. His infamous Up Yours Delors Sun front page, for example, appeared in November 1990. Johnson's sub-Woodhouseian flights of fancy were a lot more palatable, and the misrepresentations of what EU membership entailed much subtler. Their impact, however, was considerable, as he explained himself in 2005. "I was just chucking these rocks over the garden wall, and I'd listened to this amazing crash from the greenhouse next door over in England, as everything I wrote from Brussels was having this amazing explosive effect on the Tory party, and it really gave me this, I suppose, rather weird sense of power." The rocks appear ridiculous now, but then so does almost everything about Boris Johnson. At the time, they were incredibly effective. They read like a collection of April Fool's Day hoaxes, but their consequences were far from funny, wrote Martin Fletcher, a former foreign editor of The Times, in 2019. They helped ignite the simmering Euroscepticism of the conservative right. They also set the tone for much of the rest of British journalism, which found Johnson's cartoon caricature of Brussels much more appealing than the real thing. I know this because I later became the Brussels correspondent for a rival paper, and it had become almost impossible to write serious stories about the EU, even for my more discerning readers. In May 1991, Fletcher recalls, under the headline, "Italy Fails to Measure Up on Condoms," Johnson wrote that Brussels bureaucrats have shown their legendary attention to detail by rejecting new specifications for condom dimensions, claiming that the Italian rubber industry had sought a smaller minimum width because of the dimensions of Italian penises. He quoted an official spokesperson, Willie Halen, as stating, "This is a very serious business." 30 years later, Halen told The Observer Johnson had written a load of bullshit, explaining, "We were not interested by sizes. We had requests from medical institutions across Europe to check on the safety of condoms. That has nothing to do with the size of dicks." All the journalists went on about comparing the size of penises in Germany and France. It's about safety, because so many doctors were interested to know about the risks for AIDS patients, he said, before describing Johnson. "He was the paramount of exaggeration and distortion and lies. He was a clown. A successful clown." In March 1992, there was more bullshit, this time literally. Under the headline, "Brussels recruits sniffers to ensure that Euro manure smells the same," he claimed that a smelly farmyard could become an offence under Brussels' plans to quantify maximum permissible odours from manure heaps. 2 months later, the headline was "Delors Plan to Rule Europe," and the story, "European foreign ministers were stunned yesterday to learn of a plan by Jacques Delors to transform the Brussels Commission into a European government, with himself or his successor becoming a fully-fledged president of the European community." A few days after this piece was published, in a perfect illustration of the serious consequences Johnson's silliness would have almost 25 years later, Denmark voted against the Maastricht Treaty with a majority of just 50.7%. Johnson later claimed his story, picked up extensively by Danish media, had helped to swing the result. He was probably not exaggerating. "It definitely had an impact," said Uffe Ellemann-Jensen, Denmark's then foreign minister. "The story was that once the Danes had voted yes, then we would have much more Europe, much more union, and all that stuff. When I said it was nonsense, I was called a bloody liar." Sonia Pernell, Johnson's deputy in Brussels and one of his first former colleagues to warn against the dangers of his political ambitions, explains in her excellent 2012 biography, Just Boris, that this cavalcade of calumnies inspired and informed the growth of UKIP, the platform from which Nigel Farage would later launch his own toxic misrepresentations of the EU. Among countless other nonsenses and shameless exaggerations, Johnson reported that the pinkness of the British breakfast sausage was imperiled, there would be a directive on a standardised Euro coffin, and the Berlaymont building, Brussels headquarters of the European Community, is to be blown up. The 13-storey building, which is to be replaced because of the danger from asbestos used in its construction. The building, needless to say, is still standing. A particularly pungent example from November 1993, shortly before he was recalled to London, perfectly illustrates the patrician suspicion of Johnny Foreigner that Johnson did not personally feel, but would always prove more than happy to indulge. Under the headline, "Coming Soon, the Day Herr Speaker Rules Westminster," he wrote, "Achtung, British domestic politicians, your lives are set to change. Your wards, town halls, your seats are targets for the Maastricht Euro carpet baggers. The treaty's new electoral law could even allow Germans, French, Italians, and other EEC nationals to stand as Westminster MPs, or, indeed, to be raised to the peerage." This, too, never came to pass, although the Labour MP who chaired the Vote Leave campaign committee, Gisela Stewart, was born and raised in West Germany. Boris Johnson would later put her in the House of Lords. He also, of course, ennobled Charles Moore, who was editor of the Sunday Telegraph, for the last 2 years of Johnson's Brussels posting. He makes for an interesting comparison today with Max Hastings, his counterpart at the Daily Title, who has subsequently repented of his role in promoting, platforming and amplifying Johnson. "I have known Johnson since the 1980s when I edited the Daily Telegraph and he was our flamboyant Brussels correspondent," Hastings wrote in 2019 under the headline, "I was Boris Johnson's boss. He is utterly unfit to be Prime Minister. I have argued for a decade that, while he is a brilliant entertainer who made a popular maitre d' for London as its mayor, he is unfit for national office because it seems he cares for no interest save his own fame and gratification." Moore, as we have seen, remained a fully paid-up member of the Johnson fan club. In August 2023, Ivo Dornay, Johnson's brother-in-law and foreign editor of the Sunday Telegraph under Moore, provided a helpful answer to the lingering question of how Johnson's lies and exaggerations could possibly have been printed by supposedly respectable individuals and once respectable organs. "I objected only mildly when his fanciful, not to say purely fictitious, copy landed," he wrote. "Oh, but it's so well written," the then Sunday Telegraph editor Charles Moore used to say, as I hovered, eyebrow raised, in his office doorway. "Bung it in." This, of course, is the journalistic approach to truth and accuracy that continues to grace Andrew Neil's Spectator and the Telegraph comment pages. Johnson sought to bring it to the chairmanship of the BBC. By the time he left Brussels in March 1994, the nature of reporting from there for British newspapers had changed forever. It appears, for example, that he wasn't personally responsible for one of the most enduring media-manufactured EU myths of all time. By the time the tale of the bendy banana saw the light of day, Johnson had been ensconced in his new Telegraph berth as chief political columnist and assistant editor for 6 months. In September 1994, under the headline, "Now they've gone really bananas," The Sun reported that the EU was outlawing curved bananas. The story was immediately followed up by the Mirror, Mail and Express. 22 years later, while campaigning for Brexit, Johnson would complain that it was absolutely crazy that the EU is telling us what shape our bananas have got to be and all that kind of thing. By then, it was far too late for anyone to set the record straight. The following year, an audience member told BBC Question Time that she had revised her intention to vote Remain after encountering a straight banana in her local supermarket. The next stage of Johnson's career saw him accumulating the celebrity that would revivify political ambitions that briefly stalled when his 1994 attempt to become a Conservative MEP, yes, really, founded on his failure to find a constituency. As ever with Johnson, the difference between fame and infamy was often blurred. In June 1995, a recording emerged of a 1990 telephone conversation between Johnson and a school friend and Bullingdon alumnus, Darius Guppy. In it, Guppy, later jailed for faking a jewellery heist and claiming £1.8 million from insurers, pleaded for the home address of a News of the World journalist, Stuart Collier, who was looking into his affairs. It was, as the transcript attests, another potentially career-ending episode. Guppy: "I'm telling you something, Boris. This guy has got my blood up, all right, and there is nothing which I won't do to get my revenge. It's as simple as that." Johnson: "How badly are you going to hurt this guy?" Guppy: "Not badly at all." Johnson: I want to know." Guppy: "Look, let me explain to you." Johnson: "If this guy sees or sues me, I will be fucking furious." Guppy: "I guarantee you he will not be seriously hurt." Johnson: "How badly will he?" Guppy: "He will not have a broken limb or a broken arm. He will not be put into intensive care or anything like that. He will probably get a couple of black eyes and a cracked rib or something." Johnson, cracked rib? Guppy, nothing which you didn't suffer at rugby, okay? But he'll get scared, and that's what I want. I want him to get scared. I want him to have no idea who's behind it, okay? Eventually, Johnson agrees. Okay, Darry, I said I'll do it, and I'll do it. Don't worry. Asked in 2019 what message he would like to pass on to Johnson, by now all but guaranteed to be the next Prime Minister, Collier replied, I just don't think you're fit to be Prime Minister. At the very least, come clean on all your skeletons in the closet. I'm sure this is just one of them. Max Hastings, who, as we have seen, has long held the same opinion about Johnson's fitness for office, was less forthright in 1995. He apparently disciplined his star columnist, but did not sack him. Instead, his career went from strength to strength. A column in The Spectator, not chaired by Andrew Neil at this point, and a particularly cushy number reviewing cars for GQ magazine were the next additions to the already bulging portfolio. The editor who commissioned the latter would later reveal that his correspondent hadn't driven many of the cars dispatched for review. I once worked out that in the decade he worked for GQ, Boris had cost us about £4,000 in parking tickets, wrote Dylan Jones in 2022. Interestingly, Boris never got any speeding tickets, and I've got a pretty good idea why. When the cars were delivered to his house in Islington, the car companies always made a note of the mileage, something that is standard practice. The mileage would also be noted when they came to pick them up again. And on more than one occasion, okay, on many, many, many occasions, the mileage was precisely the same. So I leave you to draw your own conclusions. One cannot help wondering whether Johnson became even more emboldened every time an editor failed to find the gumption displayed by Charles Wilson at the beginning of his career. He seemed to hold the view that he could do whatever he wanted without any consequences. It was an attitude he would shortly carry into politics, but not before a succession of other scandals. The sex stuff, lurid and voluminous though it may be, is only relevant here for one reason, so we will spare ourselves the salacious detail of his multiple betrayals, affairs, and children born outside marriage. What is important to understanding the ecosystem is the way in which these serial infidelities were excused, accommodated, and ignored by people and institutions that had long sat in moral judgment on almost anybody else. The hypocrisy of Paul Dacre, Charles Moore, Tony Gallagher, or any Conservative MP demonising single mothers while cheering a politician who made a hobby of creating them, is clear. More importantly, it highlights how Johnson was turning his old headmaster's warning into a prophecy. If these self-appointed guardians of public decency could turn a blind eye to Johnson's sexual incontinence, they could turn a blind eye to anything. In other words, it was no longer problematic for him to believe that he should be free of the network of obligation that binds everyone else. Instead, thanks to an epic dereliction of duty from many of the most powerful right-wing figures in the UK media, it was fast becoming a superpower. In 2004, he was sacked for lying for the second time, on this occasion from the Conservative front bench. 5 years previously, he had been offered the editorship of The Spectator by the Canadian owner Conrad Black, on condition that he abandon his political ambitions. Johnson accepted the job and the precondition, then successfully applied to fight for the safe Conservative seat of Henley-on-Thames at the 2001 election. Contrasting him with his predecessor in the constituency, the statesmanlike and widely respected former Deputy Prime Minister Michael, now Lord Heseltine, provides a snapshot of the journey undertaken by the Conservative Party in the 21st century. In June 2023, as Johnson's House of Cards finally collapsed, Heseltine would provide a neat distillation of his Henley successor's success, perfectly capturing the conflation of gift and grift. Words are designed to make his audience believe whatever they want to believe. There is no anchor to any discernible truth or sense of integrity. Partly as a consequence of his burgeoning celebrity, bolstered enormously by multiple appearances on the BBC panel show Have I Got News For You, Tory leader Michael Howard had appointed Johnson, already vice-chair of the party, Shadow Minister of the Arts in May 2004. By October, Howard was dispatching him to Liverpool to apologise to an entire city after The Spectator published an editorial believed to have been written by Simon Heffer, another permanently furious columnist whose career was spent shuttling between the Mail and the Telegraph, and extensively amended by Johnson. The article accused Liverpudlians of wallowing in their victim status and overreacting to the murder of Ken Bigley, a 62-year-old engineer who had been kidnapped and murdered by Islamist extremists in Iraq. Apparently, an excessive predilection for welfarism had created a peculiar and deeply unattractive psyche among many Liverpudlians. They see themselves, whenever possible, as victims and resent their victim status, yet at the same time they wallow in it. The editorial even regurgitated lies about Hillsborough, describing Liverpool's failure to acknowledge even to this day the part played in the disaster by drunken fans at the back of the crowd who mindlessly tried to fight their way into the ground that Saturday afternoon. The new position also brought a higher level of scrutiny of his personal affairs, and it was reported in November that he had been conducting a 4-year-long extramarital affair with a Spectator colleague, Petronella Wyatt. His denials to both media and the party's director of communications were characteristically bombastic. The story, he insisted, was complete balderdash and an inverted pyramid of piffle. But they fell apart somewhat when Wyatt's mother claimed that her daughter had become pregnant by Johnson and had an abortion the previous month. Howard offered Johnson the opportunity to resign, but Johnson refused. This often overlooked element of the episode is fascinating and instructive. Johnson's modus operandi when confronted with evidence of his own lies is to bluster, distract, and then deny everything that cannot be definitively proved. And this is an early classic example. Like Billy Bunter insisting he has not eaten a cake despite being covered in cake crumbs, Johnson always backs himself against his accuser's inability to prove beyond all doubt that he is guilty. The system, such as it is not equipped to accommodate such blatant, unapologetic dishonesty, and so, like Trump, he often prevails. Sean O'Grady put it rather well in The Independent in July 2022. The lines he pumps out of Downing Street about virtually everything just keep changing. His web of lies is poorly constructed, lazily and carelessly thrown together. It requires constant repair, factor clarified, adjectives added and subtracted, euphemisms honed and then corrected, inquiries and investigations instigated to buy time in the hope problems will just go away or get forgotten. The fresh distortions are added, or new revelations, and it never ends. Even after the mother of his alleged paramour had given the game away in this case, Johnson was presumably confident that Petronella Wyatt herself would not, and so he could continue to claim innocence. Ergo, the refusal to resign and so avoid admitting a lie. Way back at the beginning of his career, remember, when he lied about what his godfather had said to him, and then lied about the established history of a palace built in 1325, he only ever admitted to a mistake. When, years later, his various lies about Partygate were unravelling in public, his entire defence consisted of stressing the impossibility of anybody else knowing exactly what was in his mind when he said apparently dishonest words. As with Bunter's cake, unless you could somehow cut him open and examine the evidence, it would be impossible to prove him wrong, however certain you may have been that he was. Johnson would stake everything on this tactic until the very last, when he lied about his knowledge of Chris Pincher's previous sexual misconduct, but insisted that he had not. Nonetheless, back in 2004, Howard relieved him of his duties. The recurring theme of Johnson surviving scandals that would likely have curtailed other careers was unintentionally captured by The Observer's Gabby Hinscliffe, who wrote in that year, "The episode brings an end to an unlikely but uniquely engaging political career. In the case of anyone else, of course, it would have done." But on he ploughed. When Cameron, 3 years his junior at Eton, became Tory leader in 2005, Johnson's own ambitions in that direction were effectively put on ice. Already relieved of his duties at The Spectator by Andrew Neil, he was too distracted by the trappings of celebrity and other lucrative jobs to make much of a mark as a junior education minister, and so when, in 2007, the opportunity arose to run for Mayor of London, he jumped at it. It was, in many ways, perfect for him. High profile and replete with almost daily photo opportunities, it also offered fewer opportunities for catastrophic mistakes or egregious lies. Allegations around his extramarital activities surfaced sporadically, but it was during this period that his capacity for being forgiven for any transgressions within normal politics expanded most rapidly from media owners and editors to the broader electorate. It would be churlish to pretend that he was not popular and moderately effective, his inevitable howlers mostly more silly than sinister. He squandered £43 million of public money on a ludicrous garden bridge vanity project and £300,000 on water cannon that were illegal under UK law, but largely because most of the media was eating out of his hand, neither did him lasting harm. It was during this period that I first encountered him, and, at risk of mitigating the case of other people in the dock here, I think I can explain some of his appeal. Because he doesn't care about anything except his own immediate gratification, he creates an environment in which nothing is taken seriously. It is as if his carelessness is contagious, and people who really should know better get caught up in it. Most obviously, this imparts an air of impunity even when he is being interrogated about misrepresentations and the like. Interviewers often end up laughing with him at his antics. But crucially, it also creates the idea in the minds of viewers, listeners, and voters that he is a jester in their court. Accordingly, they will forgive him anything, and by the time his true nature emerges, it is too late for them to turn back. I suspect that this is as true for employers and colleagues as it is for voters and interviewers. Even Max Hastings took several years to see the light, while Peter Oborne was appointed to the political editorship of The Spectator by Johnson. When Eddie Mair, one of the finest journalists of his generation and a personal hero of mine, gave Johnson a grilling on the BBC on the 24th of March 2013, it was notable for two reasons, highlighting how rarely interviewers had properly held his feet to the fire and the way it saw Mair come in for widespread criticism from Johnson's support staff in the media and beyond. The BBC received 600 complaints about the interview. For myself, when, for example, he hailed me with a "Hello, comrade!" from a bicycle on Charing Cross Road, and the friend I was with was mightily impressed, I had a tiny taste of why so many people turn off their normal standards in his presence. Happily, I did not suffer from this condition for long, but I think it explains why all the nonsense about witch hunts and kangaroo courts and getting all the big calls right and the rest would later go unchecked by so many for so long. Inevitably, after insisting that he had no intention of seeking a return to the Commons before the end of his second term as Mayor of London, Johnson did exactly that. In September 2014, he was selected as the Conservative candidate for the safe seat of Uxbridge and South Ruislip in the 2015 general election. Though few realised it at the time, the political landscape was about to become a hotbed of xenophobia, misinformation and propaganda. Lies would be indulged and incompetence promoted on a scale never imagined during the post-war period of British politics. Cometh the hour, cometh the man. With Dominic Cummings by his side, Nigel Farage playing the role of electoral fertiliser, and right-wing newspapers fawning over his every cock-up and calumny, Boris Johnson would flourish as never before. In his crowd-funded online magnum opus, boris-johnson-lies.com, Oborne attempted to chronicle the lies, falsehoods and misrepresentations of his former editor, but documenting Boris Johnson's lies and false statements is like painting the fourth bridge, he wrote in the mission statement. The task can never be completed because he and his ministers are constantly producing more examples. Even with Johnson gone from Downing Street and, it must be hoped, politics, the task remains impossible. Never is the power of Steve Bannon's instruction to flood the zone with shit more evident than in approaching the Augean stables of Johnson's career, and we have already sifted through much of it. Shortly, we will focus here on just five examples of how, back in the Commons, the Cabinet, and shortly the Prime Minister's office, he would take a wrecking ball to what John Claughton called the country's very fabric. His betrayal of a British citizen abducted by a rogue regime, his mysterious assignation with a former KGB spy, his Brexit lies about Northern Ireland, the corruption of parliamentary democracy, and his lethal handling of COVID-19. A proper understanding of all these moments renders the subsequent Partygate scandal as predictable as it was shameful. In every case, of course, the complicity of client journalists is a given. For many, the true scale of how completely he set about trashing the most fundamental checks and balances on the exercise of power remains unappreciated. And it remains so because his media cheerleaders and corrupted colleagues are still, even now, under his cultish spell. His last-minute decision to back leave was, as with every other decision in his life, famously motivated entirely by cynicism and self-interest. When Remain's expected victory was delivered, he would have the votes of Eurosceptic MPs and party members in his back pocket for the subsequent battle with George Osborne to succeed David Cameron. The fact that he had written two columns, one in favour of leaving, one against, only added to the sense that he was a politician like no other, a rare point of agreement for defenders and detractors alike. His campaigning was effective and often dishonest. He embraced Cummings's indulgence of xenophobic fears and, as with his years in Brussels, made amusing but baseless claims about the EU's role in British governance. Again, not caring about anything and believing in nothing liberated him to refresh parts that other politicians could not reach. Farage delivered the racists, Cummings delivered the wobblers, and Johnson delivered the brighter, more cautious exceptionalists who just needed persuading that the experts were being unduly pessimistic. It was a coalition of snake oil salesmen, and it found a lot of customers. After they won and Cameron resigned, his leadership campaign imploded after Michael Gove concluded that he was not capable of uniting party or country. "It had to fall to someone else," Gove explained, selflessly. "I felt it had to fall to me." It didn't, of course. But although Theresa May would lift the poisoned chalice, that abortive leadership contest marked the beginning of an era of disastrous prominence for MPs too blinkered or too stupid to understand the scale of the task before them. Nadine Dorries, later to become a poster girl for the promotion of the supremely unqualified, visibly wept as Johnson announced his own withdrawal from the contest. Andrea Leadsom, the politician invited by the BBC to tell the former WTO Director General that her understanding of the WTO was superior to his, briefly looked as if she might become Prime Minister. Even Jacob Rees-Mogg, a penny farthing in human form, best known for taking his childhood nanny on the campaign trail, was now being treated as a qualified contributor to public discourse. The first of Johnson's assaults on all that was decent about our democracy occurred after Theresa May's desperate and doomed attempt to buy his loyalty by making him Foreign Secretary. An early, potentially deadly blunder involved a November 2017 appearance before the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, where he addressed the plight of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian woman serving a 5-year sentence in Iran. "When I look at what Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was doing, she was simply teaching people journalism, as I understand it," said Johnson. "Neither Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe nor her family has been informed about what crime she has actually committed, and that I find extraordinary, incredible." What was both extraordinary and incredible was the level of ignorance required to make this comment. Tehran's Prosecutor General had said in October that Zaghari Ratcliffe had been arrested because she ran a BBC Persian online journalism course, which was aimed at recruiting and training people to spread propaganda against Iran. Her family and her employer, Thomson Reuters Foundation, had repeatedly insisted that she was not working in the country, but was there to introduce her parents to their granddaughter. Just 3 days after Johnson's statement, it was cited at a specially convened court in Tehran as proof that she was engaged in propaganda against the regime. The British Foreign Secretary's job would traditionally involve working to secure the release of British citizens imprisoned by rogue regimes on trumped-up charges. This one, through his innate carelessness and utter disregard for others, had made Nazanin's situation measurably worse. Nazanin was on holiday in Iran with Gabriella when she was abducted, her husband Richard explained at the time. "We demand a clear statement from the Foreign Secretary to correct his mistake, in Parliament and in Tehran at the earliest opportunity." There would be no statement. Neither, after her eventual release 4 years later, would there be any apology from Johnson when she explained in person the massive impact of his comments and revealed that Iranian authorities had cited his words again during interrogation before her release. "I have to say, the Prime Minister looked quite shocked, I think, when she said that," said Tulip Sadiq, the Zaghari Ratcliffe's MP who accompanied them to the meeting with Johnson in May 2022. "But I was really proud she did say that, because she wanted to make it clear to him that she's happy now, she's grateful, she appreciates the fact that she is home now, but there was a time when the words had a big impact." If his conduct on duty was contemptible, his conduct off duty could be worse. In April 2018, Johnson attended a NATO summit in Brussels, where a nerve agent attack in the Wiltshire town of Salisbury the previous month was on the agenda. The intended targets were Sergei Skripal, a former Russian officer and double agent for the British intelligence agencies, and his daughter Yulia. They survived the attack after spending several weeks in hospital, but a local woman, Dawn Sturgis, died after spraying herself with nerve agent contained in a discarded perfume bottle. At the NATO meeting, world leaders agreed it was highly likely that Russia was behind the attack. In September, British authorities would identify 2 Russian nationals suspected of it. Johnson, incredibly, made his way directly from the NATO summit to the Italian home of Evgeny Lebedev. It was at least his fifth visit. En route, he apparently jettisoned the 24/7 security detail that would ordinarily accompany a foreign secretary. In attendance was Evgeny's father, Alexander, a former lieutenant colonel in the KGB who had been stationed in the Russian embassy in London in the 1980s and served alongside one, Vladimir Putin. The former Foreign Office Minister, Rory Stewart, revealed in March 2022 that he had declined a similar invitation, saying, "The idea that the Foreign Secretary would think this is a respectable thing to do with his weekend is staggering. The Profumo guy lost his job for a lot less than that." In July 2019, photographs emerged of Johnson making the journey home from San Francisco d'Assisi Airport in Perugia. Improbably, he appeared even more dishevelled than usual. It was a surprise to see him. There was nobody with him and he didn't appear to have any luggage, a fellow passenger told journalists. He was such a mess. He was quite dishevelled and his trousers were twisted and creased. He looked like he had slept in his clothes. "We still don't know what was said at that meeting," wrote Carol Cadwallader, one of the few journalists to cover the story from the start, in 2022 after Johnson was compelled to confirm the meeting to the Commons Liaison Committee. "We don't know if there are any official records of it. We don't know who else was there. We don't know what documents Johnson had in his possession. We don't know if he betrayed secrets, either deliberately or inadvertently, about NATO's strategy. We do know that on the day after his election victory in December 2019, Johnson and Carrie Simmons attended a Christmas party hosted by the Lebedevs. We do know that the following year, Lebedev Jr. was gifted a seat in the House of Lords by Johnson, despite reported unease among security services. We do know that in May 2022, Lebedev Sr. was sanctioned by the Canadian government as one of 14 people who had directly enabled Vladimir Putin's senseless war in Ukraine and bear responsibility for the pain and suffering of the people of Ukraine. We do know that in June 2023, Ukraine also sanctioned him over the Russian invasion. We do know that neither Johnson nor Rishi Sunak have followed suit." Liz Truss, to be fair, barely had time. And we do know that in July 2023, Channel 4 reported that Italian intelligence services had been monitoring the Lebedev Palazzo at the time of Johnson's visit. The makers of the documentary Boris the Lord and the Russian Spy were shown a report by Italian's foreign intelligence agency that described Lebedev Sr. as continuing to enjoy the favour and friendship of Vladimir Putin. Consider, for a moment, the shameless cynicism required for Johnson to cast himself as the great ally of Ukraine in the final months of his premiership. Selecting his most egregious lie about Brexit is, given the size of the choice, surprisingly easy, largely because it is unique to him and involved doing precisely the thing that he claimed he could not tolerate when summoning a photographer to record his resignation from Theresa May's cabinet in July 2018. Speaking at the DUP conference earlier that year, he said, "We would be damaging the fabric of the Union with regulatory checks and even customs controls between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, on top of those extra regulatory checks down the Irish Sea that are already envisaged in the withdrawal agreement." As Prime Minister, he reiterated the pledge to the Irish News on the 14th of August 2020, stating, "There will be no border down the Irish Sea over my dead body." When he got Brexit done, there was, as everybody honest understood there would have to be, a border down the Irish Sea. By the time it came to pass, diehard Brexiters were well used to pretending that they had never actually wanted what they had been promised and were, rather, delighted with whatever they got instead. On the 3rd of September 2019, Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings withdrew the whip from 21 MPs who had supported a cross-party bill to prevent a no-deal Brexit that would have left the United Kingdom without any free trade agreements. Among the dispossessed were two former chancellors, Philip Hammond and Ken Clark. By now, the Brexit mess and attendant denialism had become so all-encompassing that politicians and public alike apparently believed that a no-deal outcome was in any way desirable. It was obviously no such thing, but he was now hostage to the radical English nationalist fringe of his party and understood that electoral success depended, as Brexit itself had done, on the support of the foreigner-hating Farageists. Accordingly, as he sought to reassemble the 2016 snake oil salesman coalition, he would describe the legislation as a surrender bill, and so portray an attempt to defend democratic norms as collusion with an enemy. Similarly, he would describe pro-European politicians as collaborators. Parliament would continue to lay bare the deceits and dangers of all his Brexit promises unless it could be closed down, or there was a hugely enhanced Conservative majority packed with people who either failed to understand the simplest propositions or pretended not to out of ambition or cowardice. Impressively, both were soon achieved, and here, I think, Cummings comes closest to deserving at least some of the attributions of Machiavellian genius. When parliamentary democracy itself presented an insuperable obstacle to the mythical Brexit Johnson & Co. continued to peddle, the solution was simple: torch it all. Parliament was suspended under a prorogation later ruled unlawful, and shortly after MPs returned to work, Jeremy Corbyn walked straight into the trap laid by Cummings and agreed to a general election. The country deserved better, the newly contrite Cummings would tell that committee inquiry in 2023, than a choice between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn at the last election. But that, thanks to him, is exactly what the country got. It is worth pausing here to reflect on what happened immediately after Johnson and Cummings secured their 80-seat majority. The withdrawal agreement was revised and reintroduced to the House of Commons on the 19th of December 2019. It would pass its second reading the following day. The revisions essentially involved the removal of provisions made in previous versions that were designed to ensure parliamentary scrutiny of what had been negotiated. Ian Duncan-Smith would even celebrate this, saying, "If there is anything about this arrangement, the withdrawal agreement bill, that we have not now debated, thrashed to death, I would love to know what it is." In August 2020, having finally examined the fine print, he took to Twitter to complain that the deal denies the UK true national independence and that it has to go. "They want our money and they want to stop us being a competitor," he continued. "The withdrawal agreement we signed last year sadly helps them." In 2016, then, he and most other Brexiters had cheered Brexit because it would somehow restore the British Parliament to its proper position as democratic lawmaker. In 2019, they cheered a Brexit bill that would explicitly rob Parliament of its democratic right to scrutinise legislation that bore little relation to what Johnson had promised in both 2016 and 2019. And in 2020, they were complaining that the unscrutinised bill had not delivered on the promises that Johnson and his daft chief negotiator, David, now Lord Frost, had made. These were extraordinary, ridiculous reversals that could only have been undertaken by a Prime Minister with no conscience, leading a party with no integrity, in a country with no clue about what was true and what was not, because, as we have seen, the majority of the media was either colluding in the deceits and deceptions or failing to call them out. On the 29th of January 2020, the UK recorded its first positive results for coronavirus after two Chinese nationals fell ill at a hotel in York. A lethal pandemic had arrived in that country, led by that Prime Minister, supported by that party, and indulged by that media. It is hard to imagine a more catastrophic congregation of circumstances. The official public inquiry into the government's handling of COVID-19 is not expected to conclude until 2026. In the meantime, it is Dominic Cummings who has provided the most detailed account of what was happening behind the Downing Street door. I repeat the caveat that hell hath no fury like a Svengali scorned, but also cite Sir Keir Starmer's words at PMQs on the afternoon of Cummings' disappearance. "Either his former adviser is telling the truth," he said, "in which case the Prime Minister should answer the allegations, or the Prime Minister has to suggest that his former adviser is not telling the truth, which raises serious questions about the Prime Minister's judgment in appointing him in the first place." I was also struck, revisiting the vituperation in his Select Committee testimony, by an almost perfect irony I missed at the time. Cummings clearly thought that he could succeed where all others had failed and bring Johnson down by telling the truth. Of course, by 2020, thanks partly to the machinations of Dominic Cummings, Johnson was almost entirely immune to the truth. First, we learned that the government itself and Number 10 was not operating on a war footing in February on this, in any way, shape or form. Lots of key people were literally skiing in the middle of February. By the 12th of March 2020, the necessary sense of urgency was still proving elusive, not least because Donald Trump chose that day to invite the UK to join America in bombing Iraq. "So we have this sort of completely insane situation," said Cummings, in which part of the building was saying, "Are we going to bomb Iraq?" Part of the building was arguing about whether or not we're going to do quarantine or not do quarantine, and the Prime Minister has his girlfriend going crackers about something completely trivial. Miss Simmons was apparently upset about a story in the Times concerning her pet dog and demanding that the press office deal with that. Cummings appeared to confirm suspicions that Johnson had not taken the coronavirus seriously, describing it as the new swine flu and just a scare story. He was even keen to be injected with the virus on live television so everyone realizes it's nothing to be frightened of. Of the process which Johnson, colleagues and client journalists would later describe ad nauseam as getting all the big calls right, Cummings realized that he made some terrible decisions, got things wrong and then constantly U-turned on everything. In another example of reality, or at least the Cummings version of it, being entirely at odds with what the British public were being told, he explained, "There's this great misunderstanding people have, that because it nearly killed him, therefore he must have taken it seriously. But in fact, after the first lockdown, he was cross with me and others with what he regarded as basically pushing him into the first lockdown. His argument after that was, I should have been the mayor of Jaws and kept the beaches open. He essentially thought that he'd been gamed on the numbers of the first lockdown." On the baffling matter of foreign travellers arriving at UK airports unchecked, he said, "Fundamentally, there was no proper border policy because the Prime Minister never wanted a proper border policy." At risk of irony overload, Johnson had, remember, been propelled to power on a promise to control our borders. And on he went, sometimes it would seem interminably. There was item after item of evidence that Johnson had approached a lethal pandemic which would leave almost a quarter of a million people dead, with exactly the same insouciant self-interest and carelessness that he approached everything else in his life. It is hard to feel sorry for Cummings, but his contrition contrasts starkly with his erstwhile boss. "I apologise for not acting earlier," he said, "and if I had acted earlier, then lots of people might still be alive." It barely touched Johnson, of course. The Mail and the Telegraph continued to cheer him to the rafters. His running partner, Tony Gallagher, editor of the Times, wasn't far behind. Dorries, Rees-Mogg and others continued to insist that Johnson was a man more sinned against than sinning and had weathered yet another storm that would have sunk any other premier. Even when his lies about Downing Street parties unravelled in public, he backed himself to prevail. First, there were no parties. Then, there had been parties, but he had been unaware of them. Then, there had been parties, and he had been aware of them, but he definitely did not attend any. Finally, there had been parties, and he had been aware of them, and he had in fact attended some of them, but he had not realised at the time that they were parties. Indeed, he had been repeatedly assured by underlings that every claim he made in the House of Commons was true. By June 2023, when the Committee of Privileges found this to be, to coin a phrase, an inverted pyramid of piffle, Johnson was already gone from Downing Street, finished, as we have seen, by colleagues' refusal to countenance his latest lies about knowingly appointing an alleged sex pest, Chris Pincher, to the Whip's office. Without in any way minimising the impact of groping, the Standards Committee found in July 2023 that Pincher's conduct was profoundly damaging and an abuse of power, it was, in the context of Johnson's career, a surprising hurdle at which to fall. Less surprising by far was his response to the publication of the Committee of Privileges report that found that Johnson had committed five serious offences: deliberately misleading the Commons, deliberately misleading the Privileges Committee, breaching confidence by leaking part of the report in advance, impugning the committee and parliamentary processes, and complicity in a campaign of abuse and attempted intimidation of the committee. Their original recommendation was a 20-day suspension. This would have been increased to 90 after Johnson's letter resigning as an MP revealed parts of the report findings and condemned the investigation as biased. All this seemed to express Johnson's cowardice, calumny, and moral corruption with a side order of bogus victimhood and Trumpian bleating about unfair treatment. The committee also took the unusual step of naming the Johnson allies they considered to have undertaken an unprecedented and coordinated attempt to undermine the inquiry in the media. The list included Jacob Rees-Mogg, by now moonlighting as a GB News presenter who would be knighted in Johnson's resignation honours. Also, there was Nadine Dorries, by now moonlighting as a Daily Mail columnist and talk TV presenter, who would soon be smarting furiously about her failure to land a peerage apparently promised to her by Johnson. Two women later gifted damehoods by Johnson, Priti Patel, and Donald Trump fan Andrea Jenkins made the cut, as did the Litchfield MP Michael Fabricant. It was the final contemptuous act of the most disgraceful and disgraced Prime Minister in British history. Even in resigning, he treated the office as his personal plaything, showering honours not on mere sycophants, but on people accused by one of the few remaining checks on executive abuses of treating Parliament with contempt. His first appointment on leaving Parliament could have been made with this book in mind. he became a columnist at Paul Dacre's Daily Mail. At the end of June 2023, it emerged that even in taking that job, he had committed another unambiguous breach of regulations, this time governing the appointments of former ministers. It seems unlikely that Boris Johnson cared one jot about breaking rules designed to combat corruption and uphold integrity in public life. After all, he never had before. Chapter 10. Liz Truss. Take away the 10 days of mourning after the death of Queen Elizabeth II, and she had 7 days in control. That is roughly the shelf life of a lettuce. The Economist, 20th of October, 2022. On the 6th of September, 2022, Liz Truss entered Downing Street as Prime Minister. It marked, in many ways, an astonishing and quite unexpected alignment of the planets explored in this book. To moderate effect, she had campaigned against Brexit, but embraced the new fact-free political reality it ushered in with often unseemly relish. Having watched Boris Johnson from close quarters for years, she understood perfectly that this new landscape favoured politicians who told voters only what they wanted to hear, however detached those descriptions might be from the observable actuality. As International Trade Secretary and later as Foreign Secretary, she made a speciality of announcing new trade deals to great fanfare. They generally involved either cutting and pasting existing arrangements with EU partners or, as we have seen in the Australian case, negotiating from a position of weakness and compromising the national interest due to a desperate need for speedy announcements. In Truss's telling, however, they were remarkable achievements, indicative both of those elusive Brexit benefits and her own considerable acumen. And when she wasn't being mocked for bizarre outbursts about it being a disgrace that we import 2/3 of our cheese, she certainly talked a good game. "We have struck deals so far covering 68 countries plus the EU worth £744 billion, she told the Policy Exchange think tank on the 14th of September 2021. British importers and exporters, robbed by Brexit of frictionless access to their largest international market, might not have shared her enthusiasm, but they would not be selecting the next Tory leader. Mindful of the thrall in which the Tory party members still held him, Truss uttered not a single syllable of criticism of Johnson, even as her cabinet colleagues had queued up to quit his government. The support of most right-wing newspapers, especially the Daily Mail, where editor-in-chief Paul Dacre fretted that his longed-for peerage might have disappeared over the horizon with Johnson's premiership, had propelled her from a distant third in the first round of voting to an eventual victory over Penny Mordaunt and Rishi Sunak as Conservative leader and Prime Minister. The Mail's 12th of July front page, "Truss, back me or it'll be Rishi," left little room for doubt about where its loyalties lay. It is also probable that the continuing Farageification of the party saw prejudice towards Sunak's ethnicity work in Truss's favour. After all, according to the National Front-style rhetoric the Brexit debate had ushered back into the mainstream, his foreign-born parents could not be properly British. And finally, more than any other high-profile politician in history, she was completely embedded in the secretly funded think tank universe. As we have already seen, one prominent Tory commentator stated that her arrival in Downing Street rendered Britain an Institute of Economic Affairs laboratory. Her deputy chief of staff had previously worked for both the IEA and Policy Exchange, while her chief economic advisor hailed hilariously from the so-called Taxpayers' Alliance. It was, in other words, a premiership primed to realise the dreams of almost everybody examined in these pages, and she wasted no time in trying to deliver them. For Liz Truss's disastrous tenure in Downing Street was not, as many accounts have already concluded, some sort of aberration. It was an absolute and inevitable culmination of the forces and manoeuvres detailed here, some conscious and deliberate, some accidental or unwitting, but all, ultimately, calamitous. On the 23rd of September, her Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, announced a mini-budget that would have a staggering impact on the country, the economy, and our already diminished international standing. Crucially, and entirely in keeping with the motivations that have broken Britain, he first eschewed the advice of experts and the forecasts of objective organisations. In a violent break with convention, one of his first acts as Chancellor had been to refuse to publish the Office for Budget Responsibility's autumn 2022 forecast on the state of the economy. This was of a piece with the disdain for genuine economic institutions displayed by Jacob Rees-Mogg, IEA fellows and sundry Daily Telegraph writers. But the ramifications of Kwarteng's decision would resonate far beyond TV studios and comment pages. It spooked financial markets and infuriated members of the Treasury Committee who were responsible for scrutinising the government's plans. These forecasts are a vital indicator of the health of the nation's finances and provide reassurance and confidence to international markets and investors, said committee chair, the Tory MP Mel Stride. He was stating what was, for most qualified observers, obvious. Without understanding the extent of the right-wing media Tory party think tank ecosystem, it is, I think, impossible to understand how Kwarteng and Truss could have pressed ahead with their plans for an estimated £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts and a concomitantly massive increase in borrowing after seeing the OBR warning. We learned in July 2023, thanks to a Freedom of Information request, that the OBR stated the economic outlook has worsened significantly since we last produced a forecast in March. Historically high gas prices have already driven inflation to its highest level in 40 years, and we expect inflation to rise even further over the next few months. The worst imaginable circumstances, in other words, for the fiscal policies that the Chancellor would announce just 5 days after receiving the OBR note. But from within the ecosystem, it all made perfect sense. Look after the rich, wibble vaguely but enthusiastically about growth, advance the interests of newspaper owners and the secret funders of free market pressure groups, and tell people that the wealth will somehow trickle down to the masses. After decades of infiltration, these values were now articles of blind faith, unquestioned in the circles in which these people exclusively move. When Rishi Sunak warned of the havoc Truss's policies would wreak during the leadership campaign, up popped Andrew Neil, Spectator, to rubbish the claims of the former Goldman Sachs man under the headline, "Who is Sunak kidding with his warnings about sterling?" Similarly, when Kwarteng announced, inter alia, the abolition of the top rate of income tax, the reversal of a policy to increase the rate of corporation tax, the abandonment of a scheduled increase in national insurance, and the abolition of the planned health and social care levy, the responses from Brexit-supporting, Johnson-excusing media were completely and horribly predictable. This was the dawn of a new age of Trussonomics and the end of 12 years of timid Tory rule, burbled veteran Murdoch Lieutenant Trevor Kavanagh in The Sun. The Mail's front page on the 24th of September was almost euphoric. At last, a true Tory budget! Its city editor, Alex Brummer, wrote inside, "The boldness and courage of Kwasi Kwarteng's debut budget is seismic." Sunday Telegraph editor Alistair Heath described it as, "The best budget I have ever heard a British Chancellor deliver by a massive margin." Nigel Farage tweeted, "Today was the best Conservative budget since 1986. IEA Director General Mark Littlewood struggled to contain his excitement. "This isn't a trickle-down budget, it's a boost-up budget," he wrote, nonsensically. "It's refreshing to hear a Chancellor talk passionately about the importance of economic growth. The government has announced a radical set of policies to increase Britain's prosperity." Unfortunately for this assembly of geniuses, and even more so for Truss and Kwarteng, reality was about to intervene. And this time, unlike with Brexit or Johnson or austerity or even immigration, reality could not be distorted by dishonest rhetoric, delusional appeals to British exceptionalism, or client journalists plumbing ever new depths of sycophancy and fantasy. In 2012, when public outcry forced George Osborne to abandon his plans to charge VAT on sausage rolls and Cornish pasties, the budget that contained these proposals was famously described as an omnishambles. A decade later, The Economist opined that the reaction to Kwasi Kwarteng's fiscal statement on the 23rd of September made the omnishambles budget look like a triumph for the ages. The Chancellor had barely taken his seat in the House of Commons before the consequences of his policies began to become clear. Reuters immediately described how he had floored financial markets, sending sterling and British government bonds into freefall. Larry Summers, a former US Treasury Secretary, told Bloomberg, "Britain will be remembered for having pursued the worst macroeconomic policies of any major country in a long time." It seemed the massed ranks of Murdoch Mail and Telegraph media, the type of Tory politicians best placed to prosper in post-Brexit Britain, and all their mutual friends in the incestuous network of think tanks were completely wrong about everything they professed to understand better than everyone else. The two most immediate ramifications of the best budget Alistair Heath had ever heard a British Chancellor deliver were a plummeting pound and an attendant increase in what it would cost the UK government to borrow money. This would in turn push up mortgages and the already spiralling cost of living. On Monday the 26th of September, sterling tanked to its lowest ever level against the dollar and was also significantly down against the euro. British governments borrow money to fund spending by selling bonds or gilt to investors who get an interest rate in return for buying and holding them. At the beginning of 2022, the government was paying a 1.3% rate on gilts. After the Kwarteng budget, yields on 10-year bonds soon powered past the 4% mark, the highest level since the 2008 financial crisis. The Bank of England was forced to intervene, setting aside £65 billion to stop a run on pension funds. Business Secretary Jacob Rees-Mogg would later demonstrate a characteristically acute grasp of the facts by trying to blame the bank for somehow causing the crisis. On the 3rd of October 2022, 10 days after delivering his mini-budget, Kwarteng announced a U-turn on the cut to the top rate of tax. 11 days later, Truss summoned him back from an IMF meeting in Washington, sacked him, and announced another U-turn, this time on the mooted abandonment of a corporation tax increase. Kwarteng's replacement, Jeremy Hunt, promptly abandoned pretty much everything else that had been announced on the 23rd of September. On the 20th of October, less than a week after the sacking of Kwarteng, Truss announced her resignation. She had been in the job for just 45 days and inflicted an estimated £30 billion worth of damage on the UK economy. Boris Johnson would soon be sounding out potential supporters for a return to the leadership of both party and country, and this blind ambition highlights perhaps more than anything else how completely broken Britain has become. In the corrupted ecosystem of British politics, a Prime Minister hounded out of Downing Street by his own disgusted colleagues could not only conceive of returning to power months later, but do so secure in the backing that he would enjoy from those very colleagues and the majority of the popular press. Literally the same people and organs that had lent their full-throated support to his ludicrous successor and to policies that had, mere days previously, brought the country's economy to its knees. The detachment from reality was complete. The willful abandonment of scrutiny and accountability by people and institutions historically charged with safeguarding both was, by now, absolute. The breaking of Britain was over. Not with a bang, but a whimper. And most of the people responsible still remain in situ, on the same payrolls, and entirely untouched by the consequences of their stupidity, complicity, and lies. It's the rest of us who pay. We hope you have enjoyed this audio production of How They Broke Britain, written and read by me, James O'Brien. Thanks for listening.